Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Our guest today is Harold Meyerson, one of the country's leading political analysts. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of The American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country. He's also been a weekly op-ed columnist for The Washington Post and executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
And in preparation for our conversation today, I checked on the Prospect website, and you have yet another fabulous article entitled How Not to Make America Great Again. And I love that you point out that Trump and the Republicans' plan will actually do the opposite of what we need to make America great. Can you explain to our listeners what it is about the Republican plan that actually won't work to make America great?
Sure. Well, prodded the column was a remark by the New York Times reporter David Sanger, who wrote actually in a book review in the New York Times that when he interviewed Trump and talked about Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again, Trump said he was referring to the America of the 1950s, which, you know, I mean, folks like us might say, well, okay, but that was still a period both of Jim Crow and of pervasive discrimination against women and whatnot. But by the same token, it was also a time when American families' real income was regularly increasing. So I looked at what what would have to happen for that to happen. And, you know, at the time, you know, the white working class, which is the core of Trump's support, their fathers and grandfathers, or if they're very old, they themselves were hard at work in disproportionately in fields like much larger fields then than they are now, like manufacturing. But it was a sector that at that point was unionized at about a rate of 60%, which is why their incomes were going up. It was also a time when taxes were remarkably progressive, so much so that if you look at the after-tax income growth of the poorest and then the middle and then the richest Americans, from 1940 to 1950, it was the poorest Americans who saw the greatest percentage income growth, 47%, and then it was a little lower in each more prosperous quintile until we got to the wealthiest 5%, who actually saw their income drop by 2% during that decade. So if we're talking about going back to the 1950s, and let's pretend that we eliminate all the flaws of the 1950s. If you talk about going back to the 1950s and you bring a factory back, which is what Trump is trumpeting, or you bring 200 factories back or even 2,000 factories back, the fact is that manufacturing workers today are in a sector that actually pays less than the median wage because only I think maybe 13% of American factory workers these days are unionized compared to 60-plus percent in the glory days that Trump is trying to bring back. And, you know, Trump's tax plans are exactly the reverse of what created mass prosperity in the 1950s. They would give the biggest tax cuts to the rich, whereas in the 1950s, the very rich had the highest marginal tax rate in excess of 90%. Under the reign of Eisenhower the Good. So, you know, if we're trying to go back to the Eden of the economic Eden of the Eisenhower days, Trump's plans go in the reverse direction. And similarly on unionization, which was the key to the relatively widespread equitable economic prosperity of the 1950s, you need to enhance unions, whereas, you know, with people like Andy Puzder, who is Trump's designate to be labor secretary, there's a clear hostility to unions. I mean, right now, the rate of unionization in the private sector is only 6.6%. It'll clearly, if Trump's people have their way, drop even beneath 5%. So even by the standard that Trump sets, that we need to go back to the greatness of the 1950s, There is no way in hell that you can recreate that economy, given what Trump's economic programs and policies are. In fact, it'll make it even more something that is long over the horizon and not coming back. You need to do quite the reverse of what Trump is suggesting, a much more steeply progressive tax system, and letting workers bargain so that they have some claim on the revenues that they produce. Everything that Trump has introduced and that congressional Republicans are talking about moves in the opposite direction.
Well said. And I think it's very appealing to hear Trump talk about bringing back the factories or keeping the factories here that are based here now, but thinking of moving out. But it's another one of his kind of simplistic slogans that actually might sound good, but doesn't really do what we need. I mean, you talked here and in the article about how you need to have strong unions that help the workers get better pay. I mean, those union jobs in the factories used to pay $30 an hour, now paying $10 an hour. So,
well, the union jobs, if you've been around for a while in an auto plant or a steel plant, the unionized ones still do pay $30 an hour, but the median wage for people working in manufacturing, if they work directly for the manufacturer, is $15 an hour. And if they are there working, but nominally employed by a temporary employment agency, a staffing agency, which is increasingly the way that factories are going these days, you're making less than $11 an hour. In other words, you're making Walmart wages. You're making barely more than fast food wages. So the whole dream of bringing back manufacturing and bringing back factory jobs has to have two components. I mean, even however unrealistic some of that dream may be. One, yes, is to have factories here, but the other is to give workers some bargaining power. So when you work in a factory, you're not making McDonald's wages. Of course, McDonald's wages have to go up too. But the whole promise of restoring factories is that you can bring back decent jobs with benefits. Well, that's not the case anymore, and for the vast majority of American factory workers, and in many of the factories in recent years, like the two Nissan plants and the one in Mississippi and one in Tennessee, workers are actually employed there. Most of the workers there are employed by temporary employment agencies, so they don't, they have no benefits, they make really poor wages. And this is a model which is spreading throughout American manufacturing.
Right. And so just bringing back the factories or keeping them here isn't necessarily a ticket to the middle class for the workers.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, in many ways, the fundamental manifestation of what's wrong with the American economy is there are proportionately much fewer tickets to the middle class than there used to be across the whole economy.
Right.
Which is why we have more of a bipolar economy than we certainly had in the good old days, as Trump would have it, of the 1950s.
Right. And, of course, there's also, which you mentioned in your article, but haven't mentioned here yet, the increased automation that's been going on, and which means you can have the same production of materials with fewer people working in the plant.
Absolutely. I was talking several years ago to John Cerdna, who was then the CEO of U.S. Steel, one of the great emblematic corporations of America's former industrial might. And he was saying, today at that point was like 2012, it takes two steel workers to produce the same amount that it took 10 steel workers to produce, say, in the early 1990s. And indeed, if you go into a steel mill, as I have, there are actually very few workers, on the shop floor, as it were. Most of the steel workers are sitting in booths and catwalks on the side of the plant and monitoring and controlling the flow of the ingots and the composition of them. which is good. I mean, it's a good job, and it's not as dangerous as it used to be, and it pays well. But there are a lot fewer workers in aggregate than there used to be, and that's going to be a factor in most manufacturing. It already is, and it's going to increase henceforth. So there is a real limit, even if you bring back factories, on how many jobs that's actually going to create.
All right. So the bottom line is that we need to have the jobs, manufacturing otherwise, that pay well, and we need unions that make sure that workers can bargain for good wages and good conditions and pensions, and the progressive taxation you mentioned. So all of that together is what made America great in the 1950s and made for more broadly shared prosperity. And we know that from what Trump and the Republicans are planning, they're going to run rapidly in the opposite direction by cutting taxes for the wealthy with the more failed trickle-down economics. And they're no friend to the unions, as we know. So we're just set up, it's like the big con man with the big slogan that people loved, but he's not going to be able to deliver the goods for the people who voted him into office, at least not the base of lower-income or middle-income America.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, would that were the only thing that was problematic about
yeah.
the incoming president and incoming administration. But that absolutely is the case, yes.
Yeah, that's one. I mean, we got the assault on public education. They want to undo public education and privatize it. They want to undo the women's rights. I mean, it goes on and on, the suppression of voters. So we're faced with it seems pretty dire. You got the Republicans with that agenda now in control of the entire federal government, the White House, the U.S. Senate, the U.S. House, and soon the Supreme Court. They're running half the states. So what strategies do you recommend for progressives now? What can we do to kind of stop the assault of Trump and the Republicans?
Well, first of all, we need to win back more state and local offices, and we need to maximize what progressives can do at the city and state level. I mean, right now, one of the big problems for progressives is there are only six states in which the Democrats control both houses of the legislature and the governor's office, and they're all small states except for, of course, California, my home state. So the states that we do control need to push rather boldly, in defensive ways. I think several cities now and the state of California have said, for instance, that they will provide legal counsel to immigrants that the Trump administration is trying to deport, at least those who, you know, aren't criminals. That is a very excellent defensive measure. On the offense, we're going to have to, have these states and these cities wage, campaigns to maximize the ease with which people can vote, maximize economic prospects. I mean, interesting that whenever, for instance, a ballot measure is put on a ballot to raise the minimum wage, whether it's a red state or a blue state, it passes. It passes in Arizona. It passes in South Dakota. Things like that. But beyond that, I mean, the progressives really need to focus on the 2018 elections, not only for Congress, but in the states. And there will be certainly, I think, an ample backlash at that point against much of what the Republicans will have done over the past, what will then be the past 2 years, and provide, I think, a better climate for Democrats at election time than they had during the midterm elections during Barack Obama's presidency. So that's part of it. At the federal level, I think, the Democrats need to do everything they can to oppose Trumpism, including his cabinet nominees. There are actually a couple who, the Democrats don't have to conduct all that warfare against. That's just this guy he just appointed to his new trade representative position, who I think is actually pretty acceptable to Democrats concerned about the trade issue. But, you know, the rest, as you yourself just said, seem to be opposed both to the work of the departments they're supposed to head and the whole purpose of their departments. We have an incoming labor secretary who is has said he's would rather have robots than humans working in his establishments. Andy Puzder referring to his Carl's Jr. and Hardee's fast food joints. An incoming education secretary who's opposed to public education. An incoming EPA administrator who denies climate change. An incoming energy secretary who said he doesn't think there should be an energy department. So we have an absurd group of people, not to mention a huge collection of Goldman Sachs alums who are about to descend upon departments that are supposed to be guaranteeing rights these folks want to take away. Most particularly, Jeff Sessions, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions is his actual name, to be Attorney General, supposedly defending Americans' rights, when he's been a vehement opponent of voting rights and civil rights. And so we really have to, you know, make an all-out fight. We won't win on most of these unless something comes up which is makes even, you know, Republicans hesitate to vote for them. But need to make a really strong fight against these folks and what I fear Trump is going to do in terms of judicial appointments as well.
Yeah, it's a big mess running fast in the wrong direction.
Yep.
We take some comfort in the fact that from the vote count we got, that Hillary Clinton got over or about 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. But what really bothers me about this election was the interference by Russia in the election in terms of hacking into emails for the Democratic candidate, into the Democratic Party, and releasing them, you know, with the intention to support Donald Trump and help elect Donald Trump. There's also, which has gotten less attention, at least 20 states had their state voter systems probed, and there was some investigation into that during the campaign season, but we haven't heard much about that, but, you know, was that the Russians, and what impact did that have? Did they affect who was on the voter rolls or the counting of the votes? There's still a lot to be revealed about the Russian interference with the election. I am wondering what is happening that the Democrats are not making more noise about it. I mean, imagine if it were the reverse and a foreign country had interfered in the election on behalf of the Democrat. The Russian, the Republicans would be screaming about illegitimate, have a revote. All you would hear about would be Russia, 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 like they did Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi. How come the Democrats aren't making more noise about this Russian interference in our election?
Well, they are making some noise, and interestingly, the intelligence services and the are making a lot of noise about it, including James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, testifying today in Congress, saying that Russia clearly manipulated, got involved in the involved in the election. What's really also fascinating about all of this is the complete realignment of most American conservatives on the whole notion of Russia, which is headed by a former agent of the KGB, Vladimir Putin. And, you know, what that suggests to me is really some of the international divisions that have defined us for a very long time have given way emotionally to really civil divisions. Most Americans are at this point, I think, more invested in fighting other Americans than they are in any foreign alignment, yes or no. And of course, it's most dramatically seen among the Republicans, who were, the more vehement cold warriors, and suddenly are saying Julian Assange and Vladimir Putin are really are really our guys. Something we began to see some years ago when Pat Buchanan started writing favorably in his columns about Vladimir Putin, because like Buchanan, he was a homophobe and, you know, liked traditional Orthodox religion. This now seems to me more the dividing line in America than, you know, the traditional foreign policy alignment, something which, you know, essentially the American elite can't quite get its head around, because it was formed thinking about these foreign policy alignments. You know, you watch Fox News or all of that, and the people they go after aren't other, you know, other than Islamic terrorists. The ire is directed against against other Americans. And, you know, to a certain degree, the left responds that way as well. So, in other words, we're in more of a civil war mentality than we are a foreign alignment mentality.
Yeah, well, it's an unfortunate time for that to be happening. I mean, I just think it's outrageous. I mean, to me, it's an act of war to have a foreign government interfering and influencing the results of our voting for our elected leaders. So
you would think, yes.
Yeah, you would think.
I
don't understand why the whole country is in an uproar about it. I'm hoping we get a more aggressive and assertive leader for the Democratic Party coming up. The race is on for a new head of the Democratic Party. We got Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota, is running with the backing of the two liberal lions, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. We
and
got
Chuck
Tom
Schumer.
Perez. And yes, Chuck Schumer, the head of the Democrats in the Senate. So he's got some big backing. Do you think that Keith Ellison is going to become the head of the party, or are you backing any candidate?
Well, you know, the electorate is the Democratic National Committee, which I hesitate to predict, but I think Ellison's got a really good start. You know, one of the I think unfortunate things here is both Keith Ellison and Tom Perez, I think, are both sort of terrific progressives with substantial records of achievement, and I think it's too bad they're running against each other. I mean, that said, I think the race can be a little overstated in terms of its importance. This is a job that really involves building, you know, a Democratic organization. What I like about Keith Ellison in particular is he comes at this from the Bernie Sanders perspective of trying to, you know, shift the base of funding to small contributions from millions of people and getting millions of people active. That's hard for, you know, a modern political party to do as opposed to a candidate. But I think, you know, Ellison sort of comes from a place where that's always been one of his strengths. And I think, would make him, in that sense, I think, an exemplary Democratic national chair.
Good. Well, I think the stars seem to be aligned in the favor for Keith Ellison, so hoping that we get a progressive who can organize to help rebuild the party from the ground up there. Fantastic. Well, that's all the time we have for today. For our listeners who want to learn more about your brilliant analysis, which I love, listeners, please go to prospect.org on the web and see the great work of Harold Meyerson and the American Prospect. Harold, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your great analysis.
Thank you, Eleanor. Always a pleasure.
Stay tuned for our next guest.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Jerry Taylor is the president and founder of the Niskanen Center, a libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C. Prior to founding the center in 2014, Mr. Taylor spent 23 years at the Cato Institute, where he served as Director of Natural Resource Studies, Assistant Editor of Regulation Magazine, Senior Fellow, and then Vice President. Before that, Mr. Taylor was the Staff Director for the Energy and Environment Task Force at the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, funded largely by corporations and used as a policy source for many conservative state legislators. Over the past two decades, Mr. Taylor has been an influential libertarian voice in energy policy in Washington. He's the author of numerous policy studies, has testified before Congress, and his commentary has appeared in the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and other prominent media outlets. Jerry Taylor, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. Great to be on your show.
Yeah, I was delighted to meet you at the series conference and fascinated by your story. I'd like to start with, why did you invest so much to deny climate change for those many years that you did? Why was it a priority for you and those who were funding you?
Well, I was hired at the Cato Institute to be responsible for the energy and environmental policy work we did. And so I came on board in 1991 just as climate change politics was heating up and took center stage in my issue arena. And like a lot of right-of-center thinkers in the policy community in Washington, I was deeply skeptical of the argument for doing much about climate change. There were climate scientists that I knew who seemed to make fairly reasonable and sensible arguments against climate action. And from a conservative standpoint, talking about eliminating fossil fuels from the American economy in the course of a couple of decades is pretty bracing stuff. I mean, there's clearly going to be a lot of costs associated with that. And in the early 1990s, it didn't look as if it would be such an easy lift, so there'd be tremendous costs involved and tremendous uncertainties about the future costs of climate change. And so when you look at it in that fashion, it's fairly easy for someone on the right to conclude that we just simply don't know enough to completely remake the American economy with all the economic costs associated with that, and that we needed to wait until we had better information before we made a decision like that.
Very interesting. So you went out and you were speaking in a lot of venues at Congress and these media outlets about saying why we should not be taking action on climate change for the reasons you're saying, that you know it was uncertain that it was real or that humans were causing it, the costs were high, and mm-hmm. even the uncertainty about what the costs ultimately would be, but it looked like a very skyward price tag associated. So what changed your mind?
Yeah, you know, it is important to keep in mind that people in the skeptics camp or the climate denial camp are not people who believe that climate change is real, but they take money to argue to the contrary, or they're not primarily populated by individuals who are consciously going about making crappy arguments in the course of forwarding their agenda. There's a lot of motivated cognition here. So and you also have to remember that for a lot of conservatives, they've been brought up in a world in which they've been able to identify plenty of times where the environmental community has cried wolf about a resource problem, which turned out to be greatly overwrought. So we had a population panic in the 1960s, and now, of course, we're seeing that didn't quite play out the way we had hoped. When I was in college, a lot of my peers were in college, we heard a lot about the imminent depletion of all the important natural resources on the planet, oil, coal, gas, minerals, our ability to feed ourselves, lots of Malthusian disasters on the horizon. They didn't play out. And so for a lot of conservatives, climate change is just one more of the same sort of wolf-crying operations by environmentalists. But I did change my mind on these topics. Well, the first thing that happened is I began to lose faith in the skeptic's narrative on the science. The point here is that, look, I'm not a scientist. Most of my peers aren't scientists. But you don't have to necessarily be a scientist to understand the issues in play. Most of your listeners aren't scientists, and they probably have pretty firm opinions about these matters. But since I was in the business of debating the best and the brightest on either side, I found that a lot of the narratives I was forwarding, once I gave them close scrutiny because I was called on it, it turns out that those narratives weren't very impressive. But, you know, it's human nature not to do a great deal of due diligence to the arguments you want to forward if they have a lot of utility for your case. But I did that. Began to do some of that due diligence once I realized that some of the arguments that my friends in the scientific community were forwarding were misleading, they were not particularly compelling, they mischaracterized the literature, and that gave me a great deal of pause since I didn't want to be in that business. And that began the domino effect that took me from climate skeptic to someone who believes we need to do something about climate change.
That's just an amazing story to me, and I love the fact that you're actually kind of looking at the data and looking at the arguments, and you actually got persuaded by reason and logic and data that what you had been saying was not as accurate as what you're now saying, that there is climate change, it's real, and we need to take action. And I just so respect you, you know, as someone who had been a climate denier, to really look deeply at the arguments of those who are saying this is a problem, we need to take action. And as you look deeply at those arguments, go, you know what, there's actually concerns here. And so good for you for being willing to change your mind.
Well, thank you. I think it has less to do with anything about personal integrity or seriousness of purpose than what one's mission is in these policy discussions. For a lot of my peers on the right, or from the center-right or libertarian community, since libertarians aren't necessarily going to volunteer the proposition that they are of the right, but for a lot of people in the policy debate, their job is not to persuade. Their job is to enforce an orthodoxy in their community. And I think that probably is the case also on the progressive side of the fence and amongst liberals. And I don't think there's anything uniquely about conservatives in this debate that make them more inclined to police orthodoxy than to, say, try to persuade. Because policing orthodoxy is very easy, right? You can get very purple-faced. You can pound the table. You can sneer and snarl at your opposition. You can make sarcastic remarks. You can score clever points, all of which turn off everyone who isn't already in your camp. But you're keeping the people in your camp because you're giving them a good you're giving them a good show, and you're throwing big bolo punches that sound fairly plausible. If that's your job, if that's the way you look at your role in this world, then it's not all that important to wrestle with the best arguments on either side. You could ignore the arguments from either side, because most of your crowd, the people you're trying to keep in line, people you're trying to keep on your side of the fence, they're not in the business of critically looking at the arguments from the other side either. For instance, how many people who listen to this show take seriously arguments offered by, you know, free market economists on a whole host of things? Probably not too many. And that's no knock on your audience. There are not a lot of people I know do not take very seriously anything Paul Krugman has to say, even though they probably should. The reality is we read things that are designed to confirm things we already believe. So if you're not in the business of persuasion, then it's very easy to just kind of shrug your shoulders at this stuff, to ignore the arguments that are tough, to mischaracterize and to be glib and not think too deeply about them, because you're never going to get called out. But there are some people in my world, just like there are some people on the left and some people in all the political spaces we might think about, whose ambitions are a little bit greater. We want to persuade. We want to bring people over to our side of the fence. We want to make a compelling argument. We want to wrestle and win with the very best arguments the other side has to offer. We're not going to cherry pick and go down the food chain and pick out the stupid arguments and smack them around and score cheap points. We want to take on the best. So it has something to do with professional ambition, perhaps. And for people in the on the right in the climate debate, those whose ambitions are more aligned with what my ambitions were at the Cato Institute have, for the most part, left climate skepticism, left climate denialism, and find themselves in a different place. And I think that's mostly because if you really do seriously examine and do your intellectual due diligence in this debate, it's very, very, very hard to hold a position of no action. It's just very hard.
That's great. And one of the things you mentioned in our conversation in Boston was that as you looked more deeply into the arguments of those calling for climate action, you said you're looking at it going, well, what is the risk if the climate change activists are right? What if this is, you know, man-made changes in the climate because of carbon emissions? And if we do disrupt the weather patterns, disrupt the oceans, have more severe weather, floods, and so forth, that the risk, if they were right, it was actually very high, and that that alone merited some action to address it in case there was truth on that.
Yeah, to me, one of the most important arguments that caused me to pivot was the observation that a fellow that I was sitting down and talking to in my office had made, in which he said, "Look, this debate that you're engaged in about climate change and whether we should act is generally a very hot dispute about the most likely outcome from climate change, and so your community says the most likely outcome is that this will be a relative non-event with only modest climate and social and economic impacts. And it just turns out that you can indeed go into the academic peer-reviewed literature and find articles, plenty of them actually, which argue that the future warming that we can expect in the 21st century will probably be on the lower end of what the IPCC considers its most likely range. So most of the credible climate skeptics do not depart from the estimated range of future warming that the IPCC offers. They will put their chips on the very, very low end of that. And if there are no low probability, high impact scenarios that play themselves out, and we're on the very low impact end of that, you could make an argument that this is going to be less of an event than some people fear. But on the other hand, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. Of course, on the left, we argue, no, the most likely outcome is going to be higher and more significant warming. But this is the wrong debate, this fellow said. It's not that the most likely outcome from climate change is not the most important consideration in this debate. The most important consideration in this debate is a recognition of the full range of possible outcomes. So, for instance, and we consider these sorts of things all the time. For instance, if we're in financial markets, we're trying to invest our money, what's the most likely outcome in any given year? Well, the most likely outcome is the stocks are going to return better than anything else. And so if you make your investments based on most likely outcome, you're going to put 100% of your money into equities, and you'll probably just park it into an index fund and walk away. That would be the best use of your money if that's how you make your decisions about finance. We don't do that, right? Because we know that might be the most likely outcome. But there's a full range of other outcomes that are quite possible. And those outcomes present risks that we want to hedge against. And when we talk about foreign policy, this is part of our vocabulary. We know the most likely outcome of, say, Iran having nuclear weapons is that nothing much comes from it because, after all, India has nuclear weapons, Pakistan has nuclear weapons. They're in dangerous parts of the world where conflict is common. And yet, there's been no use of nuclear weapons. But there is a chance that there are less likely outcomes that are significant, which is why people concern themselves with the proliferation of nuclear weapons throughout the world. We look at the risks when it comes to foreign policy, for instance, when it comes to ISIS and Islamic terrorism. The most likely outcome is the United States is not going to face some sort of existential threat to its future or anything of the kind. But there are low probability, high impact scenarios that conservatives are concerned about. So why is it in the climate discussion we don't acknowledge the full range of possible outcomes and hedge against them just as we would in any other context, in any other policy conversation, were it not labeled climate change? Well, that didn't make any sense to me. And if you look at the full range of possible outcomes from climate change, there are some very, very alarming scenarios that are very plausibly in play that have extremely high beyond catastrophic costs that we simply cannot ignore. And if you do that, then it's almost dispositive. It absolutely compels action. And that was a light bulb that went off. I had, it sounds obvious when you say it, but at the time, I hadn't thought a great deal about that. I was entrenched, like so many people in this debate, including people on the left, with a hot dispute about what the most likely outcomes are, not what the full range of possible outcomes are. And if you take into account that full range of possible outcomes, and you don't try to, try to pretend that risk hedging is something of a communist plot or something, then it really compels action. And so that was one of the things that had a big impact on moving me from point A to point B.
That's impressive, and I'm so happy you made that journey from point A to point B. Now that you're kind of that light bulb has gone off and you see it's important to take action given the potential catastrophic impacts and certainly likely major impacts, what do you think needs to be done about climate change? I assume as a libertarian you would support market-based solutions to slow carbon emissions?
Well, as somebody who has a very healthy respect for the power of markets, absolutely. We know that price signals are powerful things in a market economy. Prices impact the decision-making of every single person in the United States and can impact them quite significantly. If we want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the United States or around the world, we are going to have to marshal the power of consumers, and the best way to do that is to price carbon to reflect the risks that are being imposed by its use. If you do that, according to not just libertarian economists, but even according to, you know, activists on the left like James Hansen and Al Gore, they fully understand that we will get far more emissions reductions far quicker by simply pricing carbon and letting market actors respond. Then we're going to, by turning loose regulatory agencies to micromanage and regulate every nook and cranny of the American economy. That is a very slow process. It is excessively expensive, and the more costly it is to reduce emissions at the margin, the less emissions reductions we're going to be able to buy as a society. And it's not going to do the job fast enough. We need to immediately act. We need to immediately act aggressively. And the regulatory initiatives from the Obama administration, while better than nothing, I fully concede that if my choices are no action whatsoever versus the Clean Power Plan and production tax credits and the various things that are part of present policy today, yes, I'm absolutely would prefer present policy to a policy of no action. But there are policies that if you aggregate the emissions reductions that are going to follow, are a drop in the bucket of what's needed. And it's very, very hard to imagine a scenario where we're going to decarbonize the American economy to a large extent by the middle part of the century, primarily based on brute regulatory force with entrenched opposition out of the Republican Party every single step of the way.
Yes, I think you put your finger on it. We need to put a price on carbon. It's probably the single best thing that we can do. And it's interesting, I recently had dinner with Gro Brundtland, the former Prime Minister of Norway and the head of the Brundtland Commission, which came out with the whole idea of sustainable development. And I asked her what I thought the most important thing we need to do to deal with climate change, and she said we need to put a price on carbon. And so, you know, however you get there, we need to put a price on carbon. And it would seem to me, and we had some conversation about this, putting a price on carbon is going to be probably the most appealing way to engage libertarians and conservatives to take action, because they're certainly not going to be wanting to call for more government regulation.
Well, that's right. I mean, right now, the default, let's assume Congress does nothing. Let's assume Republicans and conservatives and libertarians do nothing. Then we are on a trajectory of near endless regulation under the Clean Air Act executed by the EPA throughout the American economy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's if there is no change in policy. So the default is not no action. The default is regulatory action. And so for someone on the right of center, it should be an absolute no-brainer to conclude that it is far better to have market actors decide when, where, and how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as a consequence of price signals than it is to have the questions of when, where, and how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions being made by regulatory planners at EPA or in state regulatory agencies, and to try to execute the decarbonization by rulemaking rather than by market power. This should be an easy decision, even if you're skeptical of climate science, even if you think that there's no real strong case for federal action. The fact is that policy ship, that political ship has sailed. We are acting, and we will continue to act. The only question is, can we do it cheaper and better? And I think that libertarians and conservatives are uniquely positioned to offer ideas to allow us to do it cheaper and better through carbon pricing. And as you mentioned, Gro Brundtland isn't the only person who's thought of on the left who embraces this idea. I mean, I've talked to a number of environmentalists, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, for instance, who fully appreciates and understands the case for using markets to do this job. And so I think this should be a relatively compelling sell to the right. The problem is, is that, well, while there's a lot of denialism on the right about climate science, I think there's also a lot of denialism about climate politics and American politics. A lot of my former colleagues on the right firmly believe that they're winning this debate, that the politics works in their favor to take this position. They don't believe the polls to show that most people are alarmed about climate change and want government action. Or if they do believe the polls, they say, ah, well, that'll change as soon as the hiatus and warming, which has gone on for 18 years, now goes on for 25 and 30. Sooner or later, America's going to wake up and realize that this was a hoax all along, just like the hoaxes with regards to the population bomb and resource depletion, and then we'll be proven right. We just need to hold the line. That's the mentality on the right. If really that's how you feel, if you really believe that, then when I argue that carbon pricing is certainly better than regulation, on the right, that's interpreted as it's certainly better for General Lee to walk to Appomattox Courthouse and sign surrender papers to General Grant than to keep fighting it out. And conservatives and libertarians are not going to so easily sign those surrender papers when they think the stakes are as high as they are, and when they think that ultimately they're going to be proven correct about climate change. And I tell you, most of the people that I used to work with at the Cato Institute and elsewhere really did believe that sooner or later the science and the data is going to show them correct.
Fascinating. Well, many of our listeners are involved in climate action, and they're meeting with members of Congress to try to spur, and you know, also members in the state legislature to try and spur various actions to deal with climate change. What would you recommend are the best ways to talk to climate deniers?
Well, you're never going to turn a climate denier into a climate alarmist by being really well briefed on the science, believe me. It turns out that surveys have been done on this. The more someone knows about the science, the more entrenched they become in whatever position they presently have. So you're not going to really win these conversations, in my opinion, by doing a full frontal assault on the science. It turns out, and other surveys have found, that climate skeptics are as well-versed, if not somewhat better-versed, in the scientific literature and in the science arguments than are people who are more alarmed about climate change. There are a lot of different reasons for that. I don't find their arguments compelling, as I said, but it's not as if your average climate denialist who's, you know, ginned up and ready for an argument is a mouth breather who doesn't know anything. It's usually quite the opposite. So what I think is important to remember when dealing with people who are opposed to action is that most of the people on the right fear the implications of turning government loose to strip carbon fossil fuels out of the American economy and to control its energy use and deindustrialize, which is what they think is going to follow from taking fossil fuels out of the economy. They fear that and turning government loose to do this job more than they fear the potential consequences of climate change. That's really the rub of it. And so if we want people on the right who are skeptical of climate action to become to move into a better space in this debate, we have to make sure that they appreciate the fact that one can address climate change without giving a massive steroid to governmental power, without tearing the economy apart and turning it into, say, Amish Pennsylvania, and without imposing massive costs on the American people. Because that's what really drives climate skepticism. It's not so much the science. It's more the fear of the implications of embracing it. And to the right, embracing the risks, or at least acknowledging the risks of climate science, by necessity requires us to have government act in a pretty aggressive fashion, and that scares hell out of conservatives. Now, happily, I think there are ways that we can address climate risks without increasing the size of government, without surrendering industrialization, without having to, you know, make a social decision to live like the Amish, without paying massive wealth loss in the course of doing so. But that has to be, in my opinion, the main focus when talking to climate skeptics.
fascinating. So you're saying the best way to talk to the climate deniers is, you know, just don't even get into the scientific debate.
You can get into it a little bit when somebody tells you something like, you know, I mean, there's no way to completely dodge this issue, but you have to remember, it's like when you're, if you're having an argument with your husband or your wife, oftentimes the argument's not, whatever the topic is you're arguing about, that's not really what's going on. There's oftentimes something else that's really animating this argument. And you have to remember, when it comes to climate science, it's much the same thing. There's going to be this argument about science, but that's not really the issue here. The more underlying and important issue is conservative opposition to a large, expansive, powerful, intrusive government which chokes economic growth and human well-being. That's what concerns them. And their fear that if they turn loose government to address climate change, that's going to happen. And that's what you have to keep in mind when talking to them.
Fascinating. And so how are your conversations going? Presumably you're talking to your former colleagues at Cato Institute and at ALEC. What are you saying to them? How are they responding to you now that you've got a different perspective on climate change?
Well, it's a very diverse community, so it's very hard to make generalizations. People who are paid to engage in climate debates on the right are going to hold on to their position like grim death. There's no changing them. Or, you know, maybe there is. I used to be one of those people, and I changed, so it's not impossible to imagine. But for the most part, those are the toughest sells. There are people who work in these organizations. They may not be responsible for working on energy and environment. Maybe they're there because they work on tax policy, or they work on immigration, or they work on criminal justice or something of that nature. There are a lot of people who work in the libertarian world and on the right who think the climate change is a real problem and think we probably should act. It's just not their issue area. And because they work in these organizations, they tend to be quiet about it because that's not a popular position to have within the tribe. But we find that now that we're speaking out a bit, a lot of those folks are, you know, kind of coming out a little bit, as it were. We're giving them permission to be a little heterodox. So we are finding that there's more agreement with us than you might think from looking at the press. And then, of course, there are libertarians and conservatives who are not associated with institutions in Washington, who are in academia or public life or what have you. And they're far different. And there's far more agreement amongst, say, libertarians. The climate change is a significant problem. If you're looking at libertarians who happen to be in academia, there's in fact pretty widespread acknowledgement that mainstream science is probably correct on this topic and that we need to act. They're just not people who are being paid by institutions to go about making these arguments, say, in Washington, D.C. But more important than trying to move the institutions to the right, in my opinion, is trying to move elected Republicans. Because ultimately, the decision about whether to act or not to act, to price carbon or not to price carbon, is made by elected officials in Washington. So our main focus is with them. And what we've found in talking to Republicans in the House and the Senate and senior committee staff and senior Republican staff is that there is far more willingness to entertain the idea that the Republican Party is in an unsustainable political position with their policy of denial, and they are probably in a bad policy space as well, and that they need to move out of it. The question is, how can they move out of it politically without cutting off their nose in spite of their face? And so that's really the trick here, is to take a lot of this subterranean support for what we are arguing here at Niskanen and translate it into political action. And that's what we do. And to the extent to which we at the Niskanen Center talk to these other actors in AEI and Heritage and the Chamber of Commerce and whatnot, that's all means to an end. Because these folks have some degree of influence over Republicans, though I think oftentimes their influence over Republican officials is somewhat overstated. So we want to try to move their needles, but ultimately our job is to move the needles of elected officials. And in that regard, I'm really somewhat surprised at how much latent support there is for carbon pricing in the House and the Senate and the GOP. It's subterranean, and it is latent, but it's certainly pregnant with possibilities, and it's there.
So you think there is some latent support there for carbon pricing, and if it was approached in the right way, we might actually be able to get some carbon pricing through Congress?
I think so. I think that the main roadblock to having a very much healthier conversation on the right about this topic is the fear that if you acknowledge climate change is a real problem that we have to deal with by using carbon pricing, then you'll become Bob Inglis. Some of your listeners may remember Congressman Inglis from South Carolina lost a primary challenge to a Tea Party candidate, Trey Gowdy, in 2010, I believe it was. And he, well, one of the reasons that the Tea Party ran a challenge against him in the Republican primary was that he supported a carbon tax bill. That was not the only reason, but it was one of the reasons, and he lost. And at that time, you know, people forget, before the Tea Party came on the American political scene with force in 2010, the Republican Party looked kind of different on this. As recently as 2008, they nominated a presidential candidate in John McCain, who was as bullish about doing something about the risks associated with climate change as was Barack Obama. He supported cap and trade. He had bills to that effect under his name. You had major Republican leaders like Newt Gingrich endorsing cap and trade and climate action. You had people like Jeff Flake and a whole host of others who would endorse this. Now, of course, they've disappeared from the scene. Why? Their minds haven't changed. Believe me, I know that John McCain's mind about climate change has not changed at all. But what has changed is the fact that since 2010 in the Republican Party, a very robust and powerful Tea Party movement has come onto the scene and is holding the party hostage. If you vote this way on climate, we will run a candidate against you and knock you out. And they have Bob Inglis' scalp to show for it, and that has paralyzed the GOP. So people who used to speak out have gone silent. But I think that time, this era in Republican politics, the Tea Party era, is, in my opinion, probably about to come to an end with November. I don't think that the Tea Party is going to fare very well in the November elections. My hunch is that it's more likely than not that they take the Republican Party over a cliff with the Trump candidacy, and then we're going to have a new conversation in the GOP, because it's going to become increasingly clear, in my opinion, to a lot of Republicans that you can choose to please the Tea Party or you can choose to please people who aren't in the Tea Party, and you can't do both. If you're gerrymandered in a district where the Tea Party has control, then fine. But those districts are going to become fewer and fewer with time. They're already becoming very few. And if you have a general election campaign then of any real consequence, then you're really in danger by holding this position. And I think that we're going to see some evidence of that effect in November. And once we see that, I think that's going to change the politics in Washington quite a bit. It's going to change the willingness of the GOP to entertain this conversation.
That's a very hopeful analysis. I hope you're right. We're at our time here, but how can listeners learn more about your work?
Well, you can go to our website, niskanencenter.org, where we have a very active blog, as you might imagine, which discusses climate change. Our job is to better inform the conversation on the right, so often that means taking a critical eye at, say, a Heritage Foundation paper arguing against climate action, so we'll take a close look at that. We also write quite a bit about things in the that's going on in the political world and the scientific literature. So you're welcome to go there. I also think an excellent organization for listeners who are interested in being more directly involved in climate policy or climate politics is Citizens Climate Lobby. They do a wonderful job here in Washington, and we work closely with them, and they provide a lot of opportunities for people to get involved in a productive fashion.
That's great, and that's all the time we have. Jerry Taylor, thank you so very much for being with us today and for your important work.
Oh, thank you, Eleanor. It's great to be on your show.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.